Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
We're getting down to the end of the winter wheat harvest.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
National progress at 86% by August 3rd. That is 1 point behind the five-year average, 1 point behind last year at this time. A big gain from where we started off with that early harvest delay in the south due to heavy rain. Increasing list of states reaching the 100% completion mark on harvest, and that does include top producer Kansas coming in this week at 100% harvested, just ahead of the five-year average of 99%. Harvest really taking off in parts of the north at this time. Still a little behind on the progress in states like Montana, 30% harvested despite doubling their progress from the previous week of 15%. Typically at this date, August 3rd, the Montana harvest is 40% complete.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
International negotiations on the UN Global Plastics Treaty continue in Geneva, with textile microplastic pollution now a key issue on the agenda. Synthetic fibers like polyester, nylon, acrylic under scrutiny for their role in shedding microplastics during washing, which contributes significantly to marine pollution. Microfibers make up an estimated 35% of ocean microplastics. That's according to multiple studies. In contrast, cotton presents a natural advantage. As a biodegradable fiber, cotton breaks down more quickly in environments and sheds significantly fewer microfibers compared to synthetic alternatives. Cotton Incorporated reporting cotton fibers biodegrade up to 90% in 40 days. With the treaty expected to address fiber labeling, design, and disposal standards, cotton well positioned as a sustainable option in the global textile supply chain. U.S. dairy genetic sales are shifting, with notable declines in domestic sales and growth in exports. That's according to a recent article by Chris Boyer of the University of Tennessee, published in Southern Ag Today. Trend coincides with the rise of the beef on dairy cross and have increased steadily since 2016. They're influencing breeding strategies nationwide. Domestic sales of dairy genetics peaked in 2015 at 23.6 million units, but have since declined to 16.1 million units in 2024. That's a 32% drop in 9 years. Holstein Genetics continue to dominate domestic sales. They make up 82% of the market, though down from 89% back in 2010. Jersey Genetics gaining modest ground, rising from 9% to 13%. Now, U.S. dairy genetic exports more than doubled from 14.8 million units in 2010 to 30.8 million in 2024. Holstein and Jersey breeds lead export volume, with key destinations including China, Brazil, Mexico, Argentina, and the U.K. Imports remain low, however, totaling just 101,000 units last year, but over half were Norwegian red genetics. Continued decline in domestic dairy genetics usage, likely tied to increased use of beef genetics in dairy herds, while growing export demand highlights the global value of U.S. dairy breeds. Now, tight cattle supplies and strong consumer demand will continue to drive historically high beef prices across the U.S. market, from cow-calf operations to grocery store shelves. Texas A&M AgriLife Extension experts say cow-calf producers benefiting from record calf prices fueled by low national herd numbers and ongoing demand. USDA's July cattle inventory report showed a slight herd increase to 28.7 million head, but still near the 73-year low recorded January of last year. Strong demand and limited supply continue to support high prices at every level. And this is Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
If I'm going out and I'm experimenting, trying to reduce my fertilizer expense, I'm doing some experimentations with some new cover crops, maybe a no-till planting system. These planting techniques, or I'm custom designing equipment modifications, or I'm doing extensive testing with respect to soil and nutrient levels. That can all qualify.
Roger McCohen is a tax law specialist with Washburn University on a research and development tax credit under the One Big Beautiful Bill.
Now, there's really a lot of elements to this. It has to be a process of experimentation, and really you need to treat it like you're working in a lab as you're designing these things. But all my costs that go into that type of a process, such as if I have employees, the wages that I pay them, my input cost for getting seed fertilizer that I'm testing, whatever it might be, parts, for example, those are what are called research and experimental expenditures. And then you plug those into a formula and you're able to get an R&D tax credit. So actually, there can be a lot of things that farmers do that can potentially qualify for this. But you have to do it in a certain way to be able to have those expenditures qualify. In my blog article, I walk through a sample farm, and I set them up and say, well, let's say their average gross receipts are $25 million, so they're clearly under the $31 million, and they had taxable income for 22, 23, and 24 before you take into effect the research and experimental expenditures and credits of, let's say, $2 million in 2022, $2.1 million in 2023, and $2.2 million in 2024. Now, see, those are the ones they weren't able to claim under TCJA. They've had to capitalize those and recover those over a period of time. And let's say that their qualified research expenditures, those are known as QREs, they paid $100,000 in 22 for labor, supplies, testing, contractor fees, and then that was $120,000 the next year, and then last year it was $130,000. Well, when you do your credit calculation, what they're going to come up with is what I show, and I'll skip the math here, you get a $10,000 credit in 22, $12,000 credit in 23, and a $13,000 credit in 2024. Now, that's a credit. So that comes dollar for dollar off of the tax liability. Now, before the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, what the law required, TCJA required, was these qualified research expenditures. Again, that's the $100,000, for example, in 22 for labor and supplies and testing and all that stuff. That had to be amortized over a five-year period. So you didn't get the $100,000 deduction up front. You had to spread that out. So you go back and you file an amended return. So that's what you have to do in these situations. You have to file an amended return for 22, amended return for 23, and another amended return for 2024. And it's going to reduce tax liability, like I said, by the amount of the credit each year. And that's going to total up to $10,000 the first year, $12,000 the second year, and $13,000 the third year. So you're getting, in my example, the individual's recovering is reducing tax liability by virtue of those amended returns by $35,000. So it's worth it if you've got a lot of expenditures. And again, I've got a farm that has that is incurring over $100,000 of qualified research expenditures each year. Now, if you cut that in half, you're going to cut your credit way down too. So I'd say for the larger farming operations that do qualified research and incur qualified expenditures, it's probably worth it to have your returns amended to go back and grab this.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act made a significant change with respect to how we handle the tax treatment of research and development, the research and experimental expenditures that feed into the research and development tax credit.
Washburn University tax law specialist Roger McCohen.
Before TCJA took effect on this provision starting in 2022, a business that was incurring research and experimental expenditures could currently deduct those. And that meant quite a big deal for purposes of the R&D tax credit. You didn't have to amortize those or capitalize those and amortize them over 5 years, which is what happened under TCJA. So effective for years beginning after 2021, you didn't get as big of an upfront deduction on your return or credit on your return as you would, before this TCJA provision took effect. We've kind of gone back to where we were before TCJA changed the rules again starting in 2022. And so we get upfront deduction of research and experimental expenditures that feed into the R&D tax credit. So that's a big deal. We don't have to expense these expenditures anymore. We get a current deduction with a twist. The twist in this whole thing, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act allows certain businesses to make an election to apply the new rule retroactively to research and experimental expenses that are paid or incurred in tax years beginning after 21. So you can go back and get your expenses in 22, 23, and 24 if you qualify and if you make an election. So you got to do those two things. What I mean by if you qualify is you have to be a small business that meets a specific test. And most of our Kansas operations are going to qualify for this because the test is defined as having average annual gross receipts of $31 million or less for the three tax years preceding the year in question. So that's your threshold that is used, and that's based on some other rules that are used for other portions of the code.
One Big Beautiful Bill is done, but what awaits Congress after the recess? Cody Besant, Plains Cotton Growers.
The main thing that has to be done is either Congress passes a full level of appropriations packages that'll get them in through to their new fiscal year that will begin in October, or they will have to do somewhat of a short-term or long-term CR, whichever they could muster up to do. In many instances, they've opted to use a short-term CR to maybe build it out for another month or two for negotiations. Absent doing that, then ultimately we would see a governmental shutdown. We haven't seen one of those in quite some time, and I hope that it doesn't get to that point. But in the event if that does happen, it will cause some consternation, some challenges. So, by example, FSA employees that are currently implementing the disaster program and the economic assistance program and signing up people for PLC and ARC and other programs or providing those program payments, they would be furloughed. And so they would have to close those offices until the government could essentially reopen. So that's one detrimental thing, especially in a time where these programs need to be continue to be implemented. And also from an employee standpoint, for the FSA employees, you know, they have bills to pay, they have families to take care of. And so government will have to be really aggressive in coming back with not a lot of runway and time frame to do all of this. I know a month sounds like a lot of time, but in congressional hours, it's not really a lot of time to get a lot of heavy lifting done. Encompassing that, you've got the administration that still is seeking to have all their appointees completed, and they've been very aggressive in that in the Senate. Unfortunately, they were unable to complete that task by the time they went into recess, and so that'll be another thing I'm sure that the president and other members are pushing forward during this time frame as well. So a lot to do.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Lumber future prices continued their climb last week, gaining 3.2% to $552 per thousand board feet. It marks a 39% increase from just 1 year ago. Softwood lumber prices overall are up nearly 17% year over year. It's driven by constrained supply, trade frictions, rising demand, and housing and manufacturing. Now, a key driver of recent price increases, escalating tariff rate on Canadian softwood lumber. While Canadian spruce pine fir prices rose, buyers didn't switch to southern pine substitutes despite higher cost. Industry analysts say ongoing uncertainty around trade negotiations and duties is limiting flexibility in the market. In the meantime, U.S. lumber production dropped to 9.1 billion board feet in the first quarter of the year, down 2.1% from the previous year. Imports down 5.1%.
The Purdue University CME Group Ag Economy Barometer July 2025 index fell 11 points to 135, but that still leaves the barometer 22 points above a year ago. The current condition index fell 17 points to 127, but that leaves that index 27 points higher than it was a year earlier. And the future expectations index fell 7 points to 139. That leaves that index 27 points higher than it was a year ago.
Dr. Jim Mentert is Professor Emeritus at Purdue.
Farm Financial Performance Index fell 14 points to a reading of 90. A year ago, that index stood at 81 points. And the Farm Capital Investment Index also fell. It declined 7 points to 53, but that still left that index 15 points higher than it was a year earlier. The short-term farmland value expectation index at 115 was 5 points lower than a month earlier and was 3 points lower than a year earlier. And this month, we asked producers about their expectations for cash rental rates in their area for farmland in 2026. And nearly three-fourths, 73% of crop producers said that they expect cash rental rates to remain about the same in 2026 as they are in 2025. We also continue to ask producers about their biggest concerns for their farming operation. Despite the weakness in crop prices, high input cost remains the top concern among producers, chosen by 39% of respondents in this month's survey. Second rank was lower crop and livestock prices, chosen by 29% of respondents in the survey. When we asked a similar or related question, looking ahead 5 to 10 years, what the biggest challenge to the success of their operation is over the next 5 to 10 years, producers gave us a different response. 36% chose crop or livestock prices as the biggest challenge, and only 17% chose cost control. Additionally, only 9% chose financial considerations, suggesting that entering a period of weak returns, especially in the crop sector, producers are ending this with a relatively strong balance sheet for their farm operation. This month's survey was conducted just after passage of the One Big Beautiful Bill by Congress, which provided some clarity with respect to farm bill support levels, especially the PLC and ARC prices for crops. And so we asked producers if they expect the farm safety net provided by U.S. farm programs in the 2025 farm bill will be stronger than, weaker than, or about the same as the previous bill. The percentage expecting stronger support than the previous farm bill was doubled. About 31% said stronger than, whereas 15% said weaker than. Finally, the last question on the survey was, would you say things in the U.S. today are generally headed in the right direction or in the wrong track? And 74% of respondents in this month's survey said right direction versus 26% who chose wrong track.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
That being said, one of the challenges we're still seeing, and as well as other areas of the U.S., is just acreage is down.
Cody Besson is CEO, Plains Cotton Growers.
Other alternative crops were planted just because of the cost of the inputs as compared to the cost or price they may receive. And so others are trying to kind of look at rotational matters in order to at least sustain themselves and maybe try to be profitable or try to break even in the dire conditions we've seen in the marketplace.
But there is some assistance through the One Big Beautiful Bill. Is it good for ag?
The One Big Beautiful Bill is exactly as it sounds. It is a charismatically pieced together monumental legislation that has been worked on for a multitude of years, especially on the farm policy standpoint. It essentially would create a relative six-year farm bill now that's fully up and running, or will be, but it provides some sustainability long-term versus where we were at prior to this, where the political dynamics just weren't obviously there at the previous administration and previous Congress to be able to get a long-term farm bill enacted. As far as the policy initiatives that were included, pretty much everything that industry had been advocating for was included in that. So by example, Title I, or the commodity-based title, reference prices were increased to address more of the cost of doing business today compared to what we've been since 2018. That'll be effective for the 25 crop year, so the current crop year that we're in. And fortunately, Congress and some of the policy writers had enough leverage and sense to make it active for the 25 crop year and make it where producers would, instead of having to go back and make changes in the decisions they'd already made back in March, they simply just give them the best policy for this year and then be able to build out the remaining portions of Title I going into the 26 crop year. So that's one positive. Increasing payment limits certainly is another, as businesses continue to grow, as, again, cost of doing business just becomes more increasing. That limit was certainly undermining where it needed to be in a true safety net. Additionally, another positive is, I know there's many different farm structures from a joint venture or general partnership. Those have been treated differently from a taxable standpoint or a payment limit standpoint. And now what they've done is increase the overall level playing field for a pass-through entity. So an LLC or an S-corp will be treated exactly the same now as what a general partnership or a joint venture has been treated for a number of years now. So that's some positivity as well. We've got other programs, the conservation title. There was a large amount of enhancement for conservation programs we use, such as EQIP or CSP and CRP acres. You get into the trade title. There was a doubling of MAP and FMD funds, which for the agriculture industry, cotton specifically, is very important as we use matching dollars from producers across the U.S. to be able to encompass and get really aggressive in courting export markets overseas, which we need very systemically in order to have a good, robust export market for our cotton that we export 90% of predominantly. Coupled with that, you get into the interim title, which is another one that's very favorable for the agriculture industry. There's a lot of positives that have come out of that, such as increasing the level of parity with the supplemental coverage option to the stacks program that cotton uses. And so growers will have an option now of participating in either one of those, whichever is best fit for their operation. And those are just a couple of the many key provisions that this farm bill enhances and really builds out a more robust and viable safety net that works on behalf of production agriculture and the overall industry as a whole.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Cash trade was strong last week in cattle, and box beef is softening, if not retreating, and that's not a good combination.
Bob Maurer with Manduca Trading in Chicago.
Prices are increasing, and on the back end, the wholesale that you're selling these products at, once you process them, is kind of contracting or just stable. That's not necessarily a great scenario. It has to be sustained at times, often in the cattle and hog industries, because you got to keep the lights on regardless. But it just comes down to how long that is going to continue in that particular situation, right? So beyond that, the cattle and feeder number is kind of indicative of how we got where we are. The on-feed number as of July 1, as we know, was the lowest in 17 years. We had placements that were much weaker than expected. So in terms of just the quantity of head out there, we are where we are with the prices. It makes sense. However, we are seeing higher weights. Carcass weights are increasing. Steers are up 19 pounds or so year on year. Heifers are up around 24 pounds year on year. And why that's important is that even though we have not as many head out there, we do have higher weights, which are offsetting the quantity of head out there just in terms of the raw amount of meat that's being produced. One thing that's kind of interesting and working its way into the market is the fact that we've got the heifer and cow slaughters, which are down significantly. So what this does basically is supports longer-term bullish fundamentals due to tighter breeding stocks. So those aren't animals that are going to market. Those are animals that are being held back to try to rebuild this herd, which seems to be long overdue and doesn't happen overnight. But maybe this is the start of something a little bit more significant in terms of turning the corner over the next few years in terms of these prices based on the quantity of cattle out there. So we'll see how that all plays out. New tariffs, global trade tensions, they're not affecting the cattle market directly, in my opinion, but down the road it could influence the U.S. beef export competitiveness, especially with Brazil ramping up its exports to Mexico. So we'll see how that all plays out. Hogs had a decent little rebound in pork cutout values. I think that helped prices pop up a little bit. Obviously, they're not seeing the significant continued rally that cattle had been seeing up until a few days ago, that is, but nonetheless, they've already fallen off some, but kind of stable at these levels that they're at. Continued uncertainty remaining about export demand and trade policy. Carcass weights are a little bit lighter than seasonal norms, so that's helpful in terms of the total production. Export demands, exports are in a bit of a unknown area, being that Mexico remains the largest U.S. pork buyer, and they were granted a 90-day extension in tariff negotiations. So a little bit more confidence there for a short window. That could always change, but a short window, at least where we give that continued buying from Mexico. On the flip of that would be just the broader trade uncertainty, like I kind of mentioned, and that Brazilian pork exports, they're expanding rather significantly, especially to Mexico, the Philippines, Japan. So we've got more global competition as some of the trade uncertainty with the U.S. kind of ripples around the planet, and those who are able to fill the gap are taking advantage of it.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Progress continues with the nation's corn crop. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says regarding development,
you've got the vast majority of that crop, 88% soaking by August 3rd, 1 point behind the five-year average, 2 points ahead of last year. Corn reaching the dough stage, moving along nicely at 42% of the national crop, 2 points ahead of the five-year average, 2 points behind last year at this time. Corn dented. Our first look at that for 2025, showing 6% of the crop dented by August 3rd. That is equal to not only the five-year average, but equal to last year at this time.
He adds corn crop condition remains stellar for this time of year.
Best crop condition overall for corn going back 9 years to 2016. We are currently looking at 73% of this 2025 corn crop in good to excellent condition, 7% very poor to poor.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.